Hi, it's Bill Weitrack, the Traveling Wizard, and today we're going to be here with Paul Carpenter. Paul Carpenter is a magician, hypnotist, man of about the town that does tomfoolery around the world, and he's here with us today. We're going to dispel one of the travel myths that you have to have a lot of money to travel. And Paul has traveled without a lot of money. He's done street performing all over the world. And welcome to the show, Paul. How you doing?
Thank you very much for having me, Bill. I'm so excited that I get to be your first guest on this podcast. This is very exciting and fun times for everybody.
First podcast ever. And we're going to do it pretty basic, but just ask you a few questions and talk to you a little bit about what you do. Now, you said you've done a lot of travel around the world. You've been to Australia. You've been to Malaysia. You traveled in Europe. You did some stuff in Israel. And you've done street performing in where? Las Vegas?
Every single place you just mentioned.
Really?
Yeah, and also, most of the United States. So I've done, say, New York, Miami, New Orleans, Vegas, San Francisco, L.A. I did Australia. I did Perth, Fremantle. I've performed in Athens, Greece, in Israel, Amsterdam, London, Barcelona, Madrid, the Grand Canary Islands. Every single place that I think I've gone, I've pretty much always hit the street and hit a show. Most of the time, it's because I don't have money. And so it's my way of survival, right? I've always said to my friends, find something that you can do very easily, and you don't need a lot of money to start up. Like no more than $15 to $20 to be able to start up the thing you want to do and go out and make money. And then from there, you'll make enough money to survive. Like the spray paint guys, you know, the ones that are on the street that do like cool art with
I've seen them in Vegas that make the planets.
Or whatever else. Okay, so I've taught, I don't know how many people how to do that. And I have one of those people who has traveled, literally. And he's not good at it, by the way. But he only sells them for $5 or $10 or $20, and it doesn't cost him more than $20 to get the supplies. He only goes out and gets like five colors, a black, a white, a red, a purple, and that's it, a green. And then he just goes to town and does what he needs to make enough money, sells 10, 20 paintings at $10 or $20 a pop. That's $200.
Yeah.
Listen, $200 in Indonesia or in Australia, or, man, you're living nice. Yeah. You know, you're living pretty good. You can live on $40 a day in Indonesia. Easy.
Yeah, really.
You know, like really easy. And so it's the thing about travel is once you get out of the United States and you don't go to populous touristy destinations, then things are really cheap, like super cheap. I remember in Bali, I ate a 6-course meal. I'm talking massive plates. You've seen this.
Yeah.
And it's like $15 with a tip. And you're like, what? How did I eat that much quantity of food for $15? But it's just that it just doesn't make sense until you leave, until you get out. And I think that's one of the big things.
Yeah, some people have a really hard time just leaving the U.S., you know, getting a passport, and then that stumbling block of, oh, I got to pay, you know, $700 to go to Europe or whatever. Oh, that you know.
Yeah.
It's going to be expensive once I get there, but maybe not so much.
Right. I think it's the mountain for a molehill conceptual idea, right? We all are scared to go do anything at first. I remember when I used to street perform in New Orleans when I first started out. And I wouldn't make any more than $5 to $10 for 20 or 30 minutes. And now I'm at like $100 or $150 for 20 or 30 minutes. So it's like there's a huge, you know, learning curve that you have to do. And just like anything else, travel's the same thing. But I think that there's a difference in the sense that if you just go out and get it, it's so easy. It's not hard to travel. It's not hard to get in use public transportation. In Europe, public transportation is amazing. It's so easy. Like, get a rail pass. I think rail passes, okay, they're a little expensive, but $200 or $400 for a month. But you're traveling, like, the entire month. I mean, all over Europe. You're, you know, Italy and just Germany and anywhere you want to go. And every single rail connects to each other. And, like, I mean, it's amazing. And you don't have to expend a lot of money on food because you can get a baguette and some dry meat and a bottle of wine and you're, you know, on living life like a tourist that's loving life and some cheese and what else do you need, you know?
And I think there's a myth that people have to, you know, stay in an expensive hotel and they have to have like meals at restaurants. But the truth is you can go grocery shopping and just pick up some stuff, like you said, cheese or beef jerky or
apple. It's something I've never understood. Like, and that's the thing. I don't go to hotels. I do Airbnb. I do couchsurfing.com. You know, like couchsurfing is this awesome thing where you meet people from other countries who want to have you in their home for free. And they don't ask you for money. They don't ask you for anything. And then on top of that, they're like, oh, let's go out and get drinks and I'll take you to my favorite bar. And it's like, oh, this is great, you know? And then you don't even have to – and then like, there's also – you don't even have to meet anybody or go to somebody's house. Couchsurfing in any city that you're in has people who post events like meetups.com. And meetups.com is another great resource for any country that you're in because it's global. And you can, like, find all kinds of stuff. Like, there's a guy who does in London on meetups.com a thing called synchronicity walks. And he has these dice, and there are three different dice. One tells you what direction to go. One tells you for how long. And another one has, like, all these different, like, choices on it. And you roll the dice, and you just follow the dice for, like, 2 hours. The craziest, weirdest thing in the world, but it's like the most amazing adventure because the dice kind of like leads you on this rabbit hole journey, you know, and it's just cool. Like that's random that you would never find at a hotel, you know, those little cards that tell you where to go. Like, right. Here's the swamp. You need to go take a swamp tour. Like, no, I don't want to do that, you know?
Yeah, a friend of mine always goes up to the left. And that's just it. Just keep going up and to the left. And see where it takes you, you know?
That's great. Yeah, and I like getting lost in the back streets. I remember when I did that in Singapore, and it was amazing. Like, I would walk through, I guess I have a little chutzpah in me, because I'll go anywhere. I don't care. And I would walk through, like, alleyways that would go from one building to like another building, and you could see other people on the streets and walking on the thing. But I would go through this alleyway, and sometimes these alleyways would open up and there would just be this like just massive amounts of amazing graffiti. And I'm not just saying kind of good. I'm talking world artist amazing graffiti that people would never know, that you would never see. Same thing with San Francisco. There's like not Haight-Ashbury, but like the downtown area where it's kind of grimy. But there's like this one walkway, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's just, it's a graffiti hallway. And it's just the most, and it's a tourist kind of a thing if you know about it. And man, it's just, and it changes, the walls constantly change.
It's like the bubblegum wall in Seattle.
Something like that. But I mean, this is like, these artists will come in and like every 2 or 3 months, the walls will change. So if you go to San Francisco now and come back a year or two later, those walls are massively different. So it's stuff like that.
They have that, something like that in Austin too.
Right. Austin's doing that. And like Miami's doing that now with the art district.
The Wynwood Walls.
Yeah, which is great, you know. And there's some amazing, beautiful, you know, world-renowned artists that we would know today as world-renowned only because they came from the street. I think only because of Banksy's popularity has everybody else had an opportunity. And I think that's the same thing what's going on in my life right now with television and the ability to sell a TV show. Because it's like 10 years ago, everybody had a cooking show, right? Everybody was a cooking show. And I think that started with like an Emeril Lagasse kind of thing, right? And I think it's the same thing in magic. David Blaine, some 10 years, 15 years ago, did his street magic. And then that turned to Chris Angel to do his thing. And then everybody started to put out little shows. And, you know, there's three.
And it changed magic. It's more casual now. Sort of got rid of the Harry Houdini tuxedos. And it's more of the guy on the street sort of thing. Hey, check this out. I'm going to show you a little trick.
Right. And I think it's much more accessible to the public as well. And I think also the information of how to do the magic is also more accessible. But I think there's a big thing happening right now where, there's tons of people putting out magic shows. I mean, there's three on Netflix alone sitting right now, which is Magic for the People, Death by Magic, and I think the last one was called Magic Trip or something like that, where a guy travels around the world doing magic.
You know Brian Brushwood?
Brian Brushwood has a show on YouTube.
Yeah, he does that sort of hacking show.
Yeah, he's great. He's done very well for himself. He's done so well for himself. I love Brian. Yeah, man. So, you know, but that all comes to the travel. All of those things come back to this idea of travel, which if you really think about it, it comes back to Anthony Bourdain. I mean, the guy was a full-on – I mean, he changed the market, really. Because it was a food show that was a travel thing. And how many times had that been done really to the point where it was done the way he did it, which was kind of like a docu-reality. You know, and it was really nice. And I haven't seen anybody do anything with that, with magic, that's as raw as what he did, which is what we're trying to do right now.
Well, tell you, you're leaving tomorrow to pursue this show that you're working on, a pilot.
Yeah, so right now I'm on my way to Vegas. I'm shooting a television show, which is going to be on the Firework app. If you want to look that up, it's, you know, in every single a store, whether it's the App Store, whatever. You just look up Firework, and it's a little orange logo with a little camera symbol on it. And the thing that's really cool about this app is that they have what's called the reveal, where you can actually turn your camera fully 360, and the image will just flow with wherever you are with your camera. So if you want to see something in landscape mode, you can move your camera to landscape and see the whole entire thing. But if the camera angle changes and maybe it goes to a widescreen, you can then change your view to widescreen and see the entire scene.
And so, that's on video?
Yeah, it's Firework. So that's the show called Behold. And that's with a friend of mine named Cody Burleson, who's the executive producer and creator of the show, which he came up with it about 2 years ago. And then I myself am part owner in a production company. We just signed a huge, huge deal, and we're shooting a 6-part, they're 1-hour pieces of documentary about Baltimore. And it's a subsequent series, and we're going to be doing about each city in America and why those cities are failing and what's going on in the interims of those like, you know, for instance, Baltimore, we're talking about the mayor that just recently got fired and all the famous people who put their money into the city and try to actually build something. And then also the other end of the spectrum, people who are social workers who are actually trying to do something on the ground level. So it goes from, you know, the whole gamut of what is this thing. And then my show, which is called The Running Gambit, is a show about basically my life, which is me traveling around and how I get from place to place and using magic as a form of currency, as a form of survival, which I guess was what we talked about in the beginning.
Yeah, so when you've been, have you been to a place and you just didn't have any money at all and then you had to go get some money?
Oh, plenty of times. Yeah. I've actually...
What's the best place, like, that you've ever been as far as street performing goes? Vegas?
You know, I have to say Vegas. Vegas is the easiest as far as
people are used to
money.
Just giving out their money, right?
I think there's a couple things there. One, there's this idea that street performers, and it's really weird. So there's two different perceptions on street performers depending on where you are in the world. So if you leave America and you go and street perform, I remember times when I was in Madrid, and I'd be carrying my case into the pitch, which is it's called Plaza del Sol, which is like a, you know, the area right in front of the
like
King.
Las Ramblas?
No, not Las Ramblas. That's in Barcelona.
I'm sorry. Where are you talking
about? Oh. I'm talking about Madrid.
Oh, Madrid. So
right.
Yeah.
So the Plaza del Sol is right in front of where the King lives.
Right.
And there's like this beautiful area. There's three beautiful sized pitches. One that can do like 500 people, and the other two about 100, 150 people, 200. And so I remember there'd be times where I'd be going up to the show, like just setting up, and you're ready to do a show, and you're kind of going through this mental thing, and I guess you kind of portray character in the street about to start a show. And I remember people would actually follow me to the pitch and be like, oh, you're about to start your show. And I'd be like, yeah, but I just got you. They're like, oh, no, we'll watch you set up.
So when you say pitch, like, you're talking about your show?
Yeah, well, like a pitch is the area in which you would actually do your set.
Okay.
Right? So the pitch is where you pitch your show.
Sounds like a carny
pitch a tent. Right. Yeah, almost right. That's the concept. You know, I mean, in a sense, you are kind of a carny because you're going from city to city, you know, collecting change as you go along, and that's how you survive. So but yeah, so I remember I'd go there and I'd be setting up and I'd be like, I'm not ready. And these people would be happy to watch you get ready. Whereas here in the United States, you've already been set up for an hour sometimes, and you're begging for one or two people to show up. And
I think people get in a hurry, and they, unless they're looking for something. I mean, we don't have that sort of there's some places, but the American cities don't really have those kind of streets, closed off streets, as much as in Europe.
Not anymore. Right. They're kind of being brought back, which is kind of cool. Like 3rd Street Promenade in Santa Monica was something that was a big project like that some, I think, 15 years ago, and it's done very well. Times Square, as a matter of fact, is actually closing off the streets, and they're only going to have all of Times Square be a walking area from 42nd all the way to 47th.
Wow.
So they're making that a complete park.
And you've worked at Times Square.
Worked Times Square, yeah. They actually, some years ago, started a petition and some other things, and they created these areas, which are these green rectangular – I think there's 7 of them. And you have to be inside the rectangle to accept money, but you can go anywhere you want – to perform. It's very weird. We're the same thing in Las Vegas. Las Vegas has somewhat...
what's that, Fremont Street?
It's Fremont Street. Yeah, they stopped allowing people to perform so on some level on the actual strip of Vegas. And now all of the performers are kind of relegated to Fremont. And then they went as far as making these 2-foot diameter circles in which you're supposed to quote unquote stay within the circle while you perform, which for a street performer is actually quite difficult, because let's say you're going to do unicycling, it's going to be almost impossible for you to stay within a 2-foot circle doing a unicycle show. I mean, that would be almost, you know, so it's very hard once again, in America, the perception is if you're on the street and performing anything in any way, shape, or form on some level, oh, he's just homeless and he's most likely a drug addict and he's doing that really hard act that probably took 20 years to put together because he needs his crack. You know, and that's the American perception, I swear.
It's true, and it depends on where you are. Some people will just ignore you if you're in a busy place, because that's you're like a distraction. But if you're someplace like Fremont Street, where people are looking for things to do, and they're expecting, it's all about the setup, they're expecting to see costume characters and Elvis walking around in his underwear and stuff like that.
Right, yeah. I think that once again, it depends on the city. Because, like, for instance, New Orleans is very well known for street performing. San Francisco 39th Street Pier is known for, like, the last 20, 30, even 40 years. Haight-Ashbury was the beginning of Penn & Teller, was the beginning of Harry Anderson, was the beginning of – I mean, so many greats started on the street in the 60s and 50s and even, you know, 30s and 40s until vaudeville and all of that kind of happened. So a lot of street performers and a lot of people who would be considered the vaudeville started street performing in some way.
What would be the worst place that you ever performed? Has there been a place where you just couldn't get anyone's attention?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to sound cocky, but not really. I'll get some attention. I'll make some noise. I'll figure something out to survive and eat food. So that's not an issue.
What about as far as language goes? Can you do the show?
No, I do a silent show. I was going to mention that. I do a completely silent show, which is the exact same show as my actual show, but I'm miming everything, which I'm sweating probably 10 times worse at the end of that show than I am at a show where I'm screaming at the top of my lungs. Let's say I don't have a microphone. Like, for instance, I was in Barcelona and had everything stolen from me. A backpack with a computer, $3,000, a passport, everything I owned in the world. And the only thing I had left was my box of magic, like my show, and another bag, which was street, it was my clothes, and that's all I owed to the world at that point.
And that's like everybody's worst nightmare, is to be stuck in another country with no money or anything.
Yeah, you don't know what to do, right? And I'm in Barcelona, and this is after Las Ramblas had been taken down, and there was no street performers on Las Ramblas anymore. So now I'm like, you know, I'm double screwed. I'm like, what do I do? So, of course, I in a survival mode like that, I do whatever it takes. And I literally put my bag of clothes down. I went to Las Ramblas illegally. And there's hundreds of people on Las Ramblas begging for something to happen. But because they've known that in every travel magazine and everything that you know, Las Ramblas is where you go. Nobody's there anymore. So there's all these people walking around going, where are all the entertainers, you know?
Right. It was famous for its living statues.
Living statues. I mean, there's some living statues there still. But as far as like street performing shows, there's a difference in types of busking. So busking can be a guy with a guitar. That could be a form of busking. A guy who dresses up as a statue is another form of busking. A guy, in my opinion, busking should be a show. It should be the way that it was in the 14th century. You would go to where people were buying their food, and there would be a minstrel playing some music, and there would be some guy doing some magic tricks with cups and balls. I mean, it's the way it was, you know, maybe not cups and balls.
You're saying don't be not passive entertainment, but
yeah, but be real entertainment. Like, right. you know, when you go to a Renaissance festival, you think of like the character who's doing some kind of show, juggling. It's an act. Don't get me wrong. The people who dress up as performers and do statues and living statues, they're just as much performers. But I don't feel like there's a beginning, a middle, and an end to the show. I don't feel like there's a reason to stay for 45 minutes and watch them. I don't feel, you know, maybe I'll stay and watch a statue for 5 to 10 minutes, but I'm not going to sit there and watch.
Well, Instagram, I think, has changed all that. I think everybody's all about now tourism has become very just 1 second, 2 second, 3 second oriented, where people are sometimes about just a quick experience. Oh, look what I saw. Here I am with it. Boom. And then, you know, on to the next place.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's the Instagram traveling concept. And it's the same with magic, right? So Instagram has done that with characters like Julius Dean or Jabrizi, which I have nothing against. I think those guys are amazing characters and they're amazing at what they do and great businessmen. So, yeah, I've seen, you know, guys, and all they do is they forego all of the patter, and they just do flash paper to rose, boom, real quick. And then that's the whole video. It's 30 seconds long, and it's got 22 million hits on it, which I think is cool. I have nothing wrong with that. But you're right. The type of travel that is being done today on some level is kind of like yours, Bill, because you're the kind of guy who will not sit still. You travel to 8 places in one day that most people would only see 1 or 2 of those places in one day, because they want to, you know, read every single little document about the information, take the day tour, swim with the dolphins, whatever they're going to do. While you're, you know, you've traveled to the top of a pyramid, you've come down, you've gone 20 miles down the road, went underground, you know, you've gone on this tour de force of travel.
I've always compared it to a restaurant where you have a choice of getting an entree or the buffet. And you can have a little bit of everything, mm-hmm. or you can eat the one thing and focus on that one deal. And that's the kind of travel for a lot of people.
I like the way you explain that, because that makes a lot of sense. I like that a lot.
Yeah, and so or you can just get a little bit of everything and then go back and have some more whatever you like, you know. Mm. And not everything is going to be wonderful and enjoyable, but yeah.
See, my whole thing, like, that's the difference between you and me. We were talking about this before the show. You know, types of traveling planning. Like, you really kind of – you do it off the cuff, because your travels are so cool, right? The thing I like about you, Bill, is that you don't pick the place. You let the place pick you. for like you'll look for cool deals on the internet, which you always post on Facebook or on your Instagram or even on your website with your, you know, your Travelocity thing where you have a deal where if you use a code, I think you have something like that, right?
But, yeah, I do a few.
So it's like, it's cool, like, you know, and then you'll post like, hey, go to China for $259 for 8 days, everything included, and I'm like, what? How is that possible? But when you look it up, it's like, oh, you're going off season. You're going, you know, during the cold of China. You're doing all this stuff. But you're like, yeah, but you went to China for $300.
Right.
You know? No. So I'm like,
I've never been so cold as I was on the Great Wall of China two times ago when I got that deal.
Right. But at the same time, it's like the coolest thing. You went to China for $300. And that's the difference. I think most people going back to the passport, going back to the, I need a visa. Oh, I need a this. I need a that. You don't do it like that. You let the place pick you. Like, hey, today, Ireland, $79 only today. And you're like, yeah, I'll go to Ireland today. And, you know, and then on top of that, you have like a 6-hour window and a 2-hour window at the airport. So what you're doing for the next 6 hours is literally creating this awesome itinerary. And the other thing I love about you is that you know a ton of history that goes along with your locations. And then, man, it's like, oh, it's not just let me go to the let's, for instance, I'm in France and let's go to the Louvre and look at a painting. No, it's let me take you on a tour of how the Louvre was created, why it was created. Oh, and also let me give you some information of these, you know, 30 different paintings and the artists behind them. And that's the thing that I love about you and your travel is that it's not just so quick that I don't get anything. I'm getting everything. I'm getting the quickness. I'm getting the buffet, as you say it. And it's not just a crappy Chinese buffet. It's like a 4-star resort.
We got lobster, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's like it's really cool. I mean, even, you know, even, and I love the fact that you are fearless in doing anything. You'll jump off of a cliff with ropes. You'll skydive. You'll eat bat, guano, and bat.
I've tried guano. It sounds good.
You know, but the point is that you'll do it and you're not afraid. And that, I think, is one of the biggest pieces of the puzzle here is you can't have a fear traveling. You like, that's a big one for me. And I love the story that I tell, but I do magic everywhere. Doesn't matter where I go. I don't care if you don't, if your race or your ethnicity believes something opposite of magic. For instance, if I'm like in Haiti or if I go to a Muslim country or somewhere where religion is very tight, where if you do some kind of magic trick, people think it's like some kind of sorcery or something. And people still feel that way to this day. But I've learned that it all comes down to the intention that you bring to the table. So if like I remember going into Egypt, into Sinai, which is kind of run down and broken down now, where it used to be all 5-star resorts and this amazing
view. Sharm el-Sheikh?
Yeah, you know, like just it used to be beautiful.
It's kind of run down. I haven't been there in a long time.
Yeah, no, now it's all the resorts are dead. Nothing's there.
What happened?
Money and, you know, Israel and Egypt fighting and Jewish people leaving the Sinai Peninsula because, you know, Egypt basically took it over back and forth and back and forth and there was fighting. And then there was a lot of people who were like, oh, we can make a lot of money in Sinai selling people tours and, you know. And then it just died out. And now...
Like Los Rumbles.
Like Los Rumbles.
Just let it go, man. Put a bunch of rules, yeah.
That's it. And same thing. So, you know, and I remember being in Sinai and swimming in the water and coming up from the water, because it's right across from Saudi Arabia, and you'll see the boats literally dumping their trash off the sides of their boat. And I would be coming up for water, and this wouldn't happen all the time, but there would be patches of trash that you would have to literally swipe away.
In the water?
As you're coming up for air, because otherwise you're going to be, you know, sucking up trash. And it's not a joke. Like, I mean...
No, I've seen that before.
It's the most heartbreaking moment. Where, because moments before that, you're in, you know, I don't know, 25 to 100 meters underwater snorkeling, and I'm swimming with fish, and you're seeing this coral reef dying. And you're like, wow, it's getting bleached. The coral reef is bleaching there, which means that it's getting a little too warm. And
some of it's from the trash. Some of it, even suntan lotion's messing
suntan,
up. Bro.
Suntan lotion. Man, there's so much that's going on. You know, and it's heartbreaking. So now, you know, it's sad, but I see myself in my plans of trips is I want to go to places that are more and more remote. Because I want to see the beauty of the world without the hands of humanity on it. And unfortunately, it doesn't matter where you go on the planet, you will find a Coca-Cola can on the floor somewhere. Literally anywhere. It doesn't matter where you go on this planet. And I've been to some really remote places on this planet. And it's scary that you'll find a lighter or a cigarette package.
Yeah, anywhere. There's really not a place on the planet that you can go that hasn't been gone by someone. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. At this point, almost. I mean, even indigenous, you know, places like in Brazil, which I haven't done yet, but there's a place that I want to go to that's called Alto Paraíso in Brazil. And it's in the middle of the country, like in the middle of the mountains and like, you know, black panthers on my friend's property, that kind of stuff. But it's also known, which I don't think you've gone to, for the largest reserve of crystals in the world. And it's an underground crystal patch where the crystals are the size of redwood trees.
Wow.
And the heat index underground is at 104 degrees because the crystals are vibrating. Yeah, just that alone sounds awesome. And you're walking on the ground and there's crystals piercing through the ground in this place. So it sounds like this magical forest of crystals and, you know, black panthers and ayahuasca. So it sounds like a place for me. Question for you, Bill. Have you ever been to a place in Brazil? It was in a 007 movie. And it's, what's the name of this place? I'm going to forget it now. Aura Jungle Resort.
I've been in the Amazon in Brazil, not the Manaus, the popular town, but the one close to the Colombian border. I've been there, and I've been to Rio and Curitiba and Iguazu Falls and some places like that, but not really anything too deep into the interior. Yeah, other than the Amazon deal.
There's this 4-star resort that I think you should check out. It's called Aura, A-U-R-A. Aura. A-U-A-R-A, I think is what it is. It was in a James Bond film. It's really cool. And it's a 4-star hotel hanging in the rainforest.
Okay.
Right? And there's like these big pods of houses or whatever, like connected to the trees, and you're above the ground and you can actually go all the way down to the water, and they have to bring you in a water taxi to the just crazy.
What's the weirdest place you've ever stayed?
Weirdest place I've ever stayed. Ooh, a couple, I guess. One was in Holland, near Amsterdam, about 15 kilometers out, and it was called Ruchord, and it's R-U-I-G-O-O-R-D, I believe. And Ruchord is an off-colony, free from the government society that Amsterdam allows to have. It's the craziest weird thing. Like, they're like, oh, you don't want to be part of our government? That's cool. Go ahead and do your own thing. You can live over there. It's weird. And there's a couple different places like that. There's another one that's called ADM, which is about 2 kilometers away from Ruchord, which is more techno crazy-ish. And they have a competition once a year called Robot Wars. And they have this big festival, and there's people who take metal and, you know, make these machines that shoot fire, and they have this big, you know.
Dutch Burning Man or something?
Yeah, it's almost like that. It's very cool. Yeah. And they have their very, like, electronic festival once a year, and it's very cool. But Ruchord was started in, like, I think the 60s. And, man, they had, like, 2-bedroom really beautiful houses, like a row of them. And they've got their own church, and they've got their own grocery store, and their own little colony, little tiny place. And it's very well known within the 60s hippies movement, and like tons of hippies, right? So I met those people when I was living in the mountains of Greece in what's called Kastoria. So I was in like
Thessaloniki. Is that like Meteora area?
Thessaloniki and Kastoria.
It's up in the monasteries or up on the mountains?
Up in the mountains, yeah.
Yeah, like northwest Greece?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, it's a beautiful part.
Oh, God, it's amazing.
Probably most overlooked part of Greece that's really amazing.
Yeah, it's...
That's been in some James Bond movie.
Yeah, it has, yeah. And the traveling of the mountains there.
Going through the little valley with the mountains and the monasteries.
So beautiful. And then when we got to the place that we were... It was this gorgeous scene. So there's the top of a mountain that you can see, that you can actually climb to. It took about 2 hours to get to the top of this thing. You actually, you know, beautiful. That alone was kind of cool. And then it was this just mountain to rolling plains to this open little space where you had your tribal fire circle for the hippies. And then they had made this other encampment to cook food. So they were making 3 meals a day. And then they were giving classes. And there's teepee tents and just hippies everywhere naked. And so that's got to be one of the most random locations I've ever lived. And then the other one would be living on the desert floor of Sinai, right at the water's edge, in Egypt for a month and a half with Bedouins who were running guns during the Egyptian spring.
And what did you spend a day there?
Oh, nothing.
Right. So you were staying?
I literally lived in Sinai for a month and a half for free. So it goes like this. I was – when I went to a – Burner Fest in Israel, I met a shaman. He introduced me to a whole ayahuasca family. That ayahuasca family introduced me to this family in Sinai, and that a lot of these kids who were in these ceremonies that I were in, we all were going to Sinai to go live the Sinai life, because that's something you're supposed to kind of...
You don't want to get Sinai poisoning.
Uh-huh, I love you. I went there and I performed. I went and paid, I think, the first week I was there. And the whole entire week, plus food and hashish and all the everything you could ever want to do, riding horses or camels or swimming in the water and borrowing the boat, whatever. 200 shekels, which is $50 for a week. And that's everything. Like, everything included. Even my own little husha.
What's the cheapest place you've ever stayed that wasn't free? I stayed in a place in Istanbul, or not in Istanbul, but in Turkey, for $1 a night one time.
Wow, that's amazing.
$1 a night, yeah. That was back in the early days. That was in the...
Oh well, no, but do the influx of do the change of rate. What would it be now if you went there?
Probably $5.
Okay, still.
It was just a cubbyhole.
I'd have to say Bali was probably the cheapest, most amazing place I've ever stayed. So, I think I was spending $30 a night, which is a little expensive, but...
You can get a nice place in Bali for $30.
Oh, my God.
A really nice place with breakfast.
Oh, with amazing breakfast. Not like a continental crappy waffle and a dry muffin. No. What type of eggs do you want? Here's fresh-cut mangoes, strawberries, every fruit and vegetable you could think, like, all, like, laid out on a table for you, and
that's
like
true.
It's just your feet. It's like a buffet for yourself. Oh my God, Bali was amazing. Once again, I think Bali for me was the cheapest, most amazing food experience. The women in Bali, because everybody from Europe travels to Bali because it's so cheap, and so do all the Australians. Bali is like the Mexico for Australians.
Yes.
So that's where you get like super hot, really beautiful Australians, girls from Norway, the Netherlands. I mean, and they're all just on vacation and just wanting to get drunk and have sex and just meet beautiful people. And, oh, you're American? Oh, my God. That's a super plus. And then, oh, my God, you do magic? Oh, forget it. So, you know, yeah. No, yeah. Bali was...
And the people,
debauchery at its finest.
The people that live there are very friendly too. You know, they're used to Westerners and...
Yeah, I met two kids who I actually went and spent time with their family, And they were really cool. And these kids were like, you know, like when you walk down the streets, there's people who are selling tchotchke, you know, remakes of Reeboks and Nikes and whatever else. And I met these two kids and they were out of a warehouse and I bought them McDonald's. And they started crying when I bought them McDonald's because they were like, man, we only eat McDonald's once a year because it's so expensive for them.
Right.
Because they live – the mom, the dad, the two brothers, and a daughter live in what you would consider an outdoor shed for your backyard, and all five of them live there. The three boys, so the father and the two sons, sleep on the floor, and the mother and the daughter, they share one of those cots that you would get for – emergency cots, you know, they fold out, and the mom and dad, or the mom and the sister, sleep on that, and the shed is literally a corrugated metal shed, and that's where these people live, and they live on $50 a month, all five of them.
And they seem pretty happy, right?
You know, really, it's quite amazing. I have this story, I've never seen this, but I've heard this, and it affected my heart deeply. This guy was like, yo, I was in India, which is like super poverty stricken. It's hardcore.
Yeah, some places, yeah.
Yeah, really, and, you know, I think he's in New Delhi at the time. And there's a lady, and he's walking down the street, and he sees a lady, and she's on the street, homeless, and there's six children waking up around her. This is as he's walking by. You know, it's happening. He's walking. He's seeing her. He's seeing the children wake up as he's walking. Now he's walking by her. And he stops himself. He just can't handle it because they're all smiling. And he looks at her and he's like, I'm sorry, dear. Please forgive me for being, I guess, American or whatever. He's like, how can you be so happy? And without it missing a beat, the woman looks up and says, I just woke up and I have my children. Like, what else do you need in life, buddy?
It's true. If your basic needs are taken care of, there's been a lot of studies on this.
Yeah.
People think that money is happiness, but I don't know if you know as many miserable people as I do. They're rich.
Yeah,
I know. They never go anywhere and do anything, and they're always working and miserable. And some of these people that I've met that are making, like you said, a dollar or two a day or something like that, they're real happy. They're enjoying their life. They're not all stressed out. They're limited. They're not going to go out and eat lobster. But I mean, is that really what? Well, okay, lobster is pretty good. But
right, yeah, right.
You don't have to have it every day, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, everything in moderation, including moderation, I guess. Right. But that, yeah, that reminds me of another place. It was this small little town in Italy. I mean, I'm talking maybe 1,500 people, and every evening at dinner, at around 5, right, because they eat later, everybody, and I'm talking mothers, grandmothers, fathers, everybody left their homes, and they would go on this little walk around the town, and everybody, of course, knows each other, so it's like, hey, how are you, and how was your day, and it's almost like you have 1,500 relatives. It is insane. And these people have some of the longest lifespans in the world. And they eat fatty foods, and they smoke their cigarettes, and they drink their wine, and
take a nap during the day.
Oh, they definitely take their naps. They take their naps, they drink their coffee, it's really, you know, it's almost like here in America, we go, oh, look at that guy. He worked out every day and he died at 30. But the guy who's 90, smoking cigars and angry at the world, is still going. I turn that around. I don't think the guy's angry. I think the guy's just being himself, first of all. And he's just being honest with himself and his body and what he wants and what he – many times – and I have nothing against people who want to go after goals in the sports world or anything like that. But many times when you do that, specifically in the sports realm, where you're pushing your body to these limits and to these extraordinary places, you're hurting parts of yourself internally, you know, like physically putting stresses on your body that I don't think you need to put. And granted, the guy is the greatest boxer in the world, or granted, the guy is the, you know, long distance runner of the world. And I congratulate you on your passion and your dedication and all those things. But at the same time, so many times in my life, I've heard of the guy who, I don't know who it was, but he was a bicyclist. He died at like 30-something years old.
I know, it's crazy.
And a heart attack, of all things. You're like, how does that guy who works out every day, you know, eats the right foods, does the right stuff, and what it comes down to is stress.
Yeah, and I do believe that there's just a lot of misconceptions. I mean, people believe that if you do this and this and this and this, it'll make you happy, or it'll make you stronger or better, and there's just a lot of myths about stuff like that, and traveling is one of them. We're going to go ahead and wrap it up.
So, man, thank you so much for having me. I'm once again, so thankful that I got to be your first guest. This is like the second or third time, by the way, that people have started a podcast or a TV show or something, and I got to be their first guest. So this is like, this is an ups for me. I get to knock that off of my bucket list.
Be the first. This one's going to be huge. I think right now I already have at least 3 or 4 listeners.
Yeah,
I mean,
listen.
By the end of the year, it's going to be maybe six or seven.
Yeah.
So thanks again, Paul. Good luck on your trip tomorrow. And thanks again for being with us.